Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. And, oh, I guess Christmas is long gone, too, isn't it? Well, what the hell? Happy New Year, at least. Back in the saddle again. We've got so much stuff to talk about tonight. We were just talking about... what were we talking about? Oh, the Major Cup. We were... Chris was commenting that if you had any kind of entry that you wanted to submit to the Major Cup, you better jump on it, like, right now. Chris is going to look up and see where the entries stood so far. Chris, did you manage to find any more out?
My internet's dragging tonight. I think the website's having so much traffic that it's really slow.
That could be.
I'll get it pulled up in a second to tell you if there's still any entries available.
All right. Well, while Mississippi works on that, hey, welcome to the Mead House. This is show number one for 2017. I guess it's about number 33 or 34 by now, I think. But heck, who's counting? Like I said, we've got a whole ton of stuff to get out of the way here tonight. The Mead House. You can find us at the Mead House. We'll get all these particulars out of the way. We do have a Facebook. It's simply The Mead House. Just type in that little search deal up there on the top, The Mead House, and I'm sure you'll find us. Any number of mead-making Facebook deals out there, they've got us listed all over the place as well. If you want to listen live, you can listen a couple of ways. You can listen from our website, themeadhouse.com, or you can go to TuneIn Radio. You can also download the mobile app from TuneIn Radio and take us with you if you're out in the garage working on a batch or in your meadery or driving down the road. You can take the show with you anytime. If not, you can always listen to us later on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podcastpedia, themeadhouse.com, just a whole ton of places out there. And I tell you, the show's really taken off. We've got thousands of listeners, or at least thousands of downloads, hundreds and hundreds of listeners so far. But with us tonight, Ryan Richardson's in the house. Ryan's got, you know, we were putting show notes together and everything, and I'm hearing from the guys today. Ryan has got this laundry list. He had a busy 2 weeks. We're going to get into that a little bit later on in the show. Jeff is on his way to becoming a full-fledged brewery. We'll ask Jeff about that here in a little while as well. Mississippi, I know he's got some stuff going on. Of course, JD, I got a few things happening here in the old Mead House. Aaron Martin, I saw some pictures, dude. You did some traveling, didn't you?
I did, yeah. We went down to visit my folks and my sister down in upstate South Carolina and northern Georgia and had a nice time down there for sure. Got to visit a brewery or two and taking some good craft beer while we were there as well.
Outstanding. Look forward to hearing about that as well. We've got some new projects that we want to talk about, some old ones that we want to catch up on. We're going to talk about what do you do with your leftovers. I did start a recipe with some leftover stuff after contacting the guys here a few weeks back. We'll also talk about what's on the hopper list for 2017, anything new that we want to try, and, of course, if there's any new equipment out there that we should be looking at. But to start the show off, usually we pass it around and find out what everybody's drinking tonight. I'll start it off tonight. I'm drinking one of my homemade wines. This is a kit wine. It's called Mezzaluna. And I don't know, I may have shared this on the show before, but it's a red table wine. It's a red blend. I don't even know what kind of grape juices it is, but, it's really good. I like it. It's mildly tart, a little bit of sweetness. It's a, I'm going to call it a medium oak because I really love a heavily oaked red wine. So I thought, well, I'd crack a bottle of this open and have a couple glasses of it tonight and make my cardiologist proud. So let's throw it on over to Aaron across the table. What's in your cup tonight, guy?
Tonight I am drinking a peach goza. It's a fruit sour beer from Blue Blood Brewing. They're based out of Lincoln, Nebraska, if I'm not mistaken. And this is a style of beer that I, maybe within the last year and a half or so, have started to get more and more into. Before that, it was just one I would probably leave on the shelf. But a buddy of mine is really into sour beers like this. And more often than not, I'll pick some up. And it's kind of weird to be drinking it on a cold winter night, probably more of a good summertime sipper. It's very refreshing, tart, nice light peach flavor going on here. Definitely would recommend it.
I haven't had a sour beer, I don't think.
Oh, okay.
I'll have to, admit, it's got to go on my list.
Yeah, with some of the meads that you've been getting into lately, some of these, like the Groenfell meads that are a little bit lighter in gravity, I could see that you might like this style of beer a little bit. I mean, it's definitely more tart and sour, maybe even a little salty. But I could see that this could be up your alley potentially.
Good. I'll have to look for it at the Total Wine or my next trip to BevMo. Jeff, what'd you pour in your glass tonight?
Tonight I got something really off the beaten track here. It's a collaboration between New Belgium, which you guys are familiar with. They do the Fat Tire. They have a handful of others that I really enjoy. And they're collaborating with Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream guys.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. No. I've had this one.
The chocolate chip cookie dough beer.
What?
It's a chocolate chip cookie dough beer. And by God, it tastes like chocolate chip cloying dough. But it's not cloyingly sweet to the point where I want to, like, just, you know,
lick the bowl.
Like, drink half of it and put it away. This is, it actually has a beer character. But wow, there's a character of that chocolate chip cookie dough, like the little bits you dig out of their ice cream. It's great.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's amazing. You know, every time I go to, my wife and I, we make the trip to either BevMo or Total Wine, one or the other. And it's always, you know, you got to cruise the beer aisle, and it's several aisles wide. I mean, there's just so much beer. And I like taking, well, we both like to take our time in the craft section. And every time we go down this one aisle, my wife, the same comment every time she sees it. There's this peanut butter beer. She says, ew, that sounds sick. Every time we go up and down the aisle, she finds that beer and the same comment. Ew, that sounds sick. Oh, but I don't know. Chocolate chip cookie dough? I don't know, Jeff.
Everything I've tried from New Belgium has been good so far.
I'm making note of it right now.
Have you tried 1554 by New Belgium?
No. No, don't think so.
That one would be up your alley if you're into the Marzen style or the Bock style. I think it's a recipe from 1554, they say, and it's got a really good dark malty character to it that I really enjoy. So see if you can track that down. I think you'd enjoy it.
Okay.
And well, let's just shoot it on over to Mississippi. Now I know you had to run off and go get a cup of coffee. So what kind is it?
Well, I cheated. I'm drinking a medium roast because my wife is on the way to the store right now to pick up some more dark roast. We ran out.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's not your typical brew, but
no, and I don't know what this crap is, but it's marginally called coffee. So we'll just leave it at that.
Right. Ryan, what are you drinking tonight, guy?
You know, when you're talking about the Mazer Cup a minute ago, I'm drinking a Mazer Cup Medalist from at least last year. I see the results aren't on the website anymore. It's another one from Boss Meadery. It's the Hammer Smashed Cherry. It is a session strength mead with Door County cherries right from Wisconsin. It's dry. It's a little tart. It's really well balanced. I really enjoy it, and I can see why it was worthy of a Mazer Cup medal.
Wow. Sounds good.
By the way, speaking of the Mazer Cup, there are 53 spots left. Oh, excuse me, 57 spots left.
There were 58 a few minutes ago, but I just registered myself.
Okay. There's 393 entrants out of 450, so there's 57 left.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, I remember talking about it on the old show, and it does fill up really quick. And I think they have cut down, Chris, if I remember right. They've cut it down maybe by 100 or a couple hundred at least. Because I remember Vicky talking. I mean, they would get so much delivered.
Yeah, I think it was maybe a couple hundred. But to give you some idea, registration opened up about this time last night. So it's 24 hours in, and it's almost full. So
yeah,
if you want in, you better get in.
Yeah. We'll have to keep track of that. I believe it's in March, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't been to the website, but we'll keep track of the Mazer Cup and what's going on over there. And maybe if I can, I still got a couple of contacts over at Got Mead. Maybe we can get some more information, maybe some behind the scenes stuff that we can talk about and share on the show. I want to jump right into the middle of Ryan stuff here. Dude, you had a busy couple of weeks.
I told you guys I'd been neglecting the fermentation room and needed to get in there.
I mean, what'd you do? Just slam the door shut and run off? I mean,
I had some help. I got a brother who lives in Omaha who is in town for the holidays, and he came over, and it goes a lot quicker with two people, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Well, talk to me about this. I'm running down your list, and I kind of highlighted a couple that I really wanted you to talk a little bit more on. You got this cherry bourbon thing going on. You said you bottled traditional back sweetened with 4 ounces of tart cherry juice. What does that taste like?
It's got – so first of all, what I do – and I've mentioned this before, is I start out, I make a large batch. When I say large, let's say a 5 gallon batch of traditional mead. And I do it pretty well at session strength for me. It's, around 5%. So, that's somewhere between 1030 and 1040 starting gravity. And I let it go all the way dry. So it comes out to roughly 5% alcohol. And then I stabilize it, and I then break it off into 5 1-gallon carboys. And I do a lot of experimenting. And in this particular one, I added 4 ounces of tart cherry juice, and then I had a bourbon stave that I had gotten from a homebrew shop. So I don't know what kind of bourbon it was in there. It just said authentic Kentucky bourbon, dropped it in. It was about an inch wide and, 8-9 inches long, and let it sit for 3 months. And when I tasted it and bottled it, it was great. So again, that 4 ounces of cherry juice doesn't add a ton of sweetness, but it gave it some real nice light cherry flavor, little bit of tartness, And then that bourbon, right on the back end, you get a little bit of vanilla and just a hint of bourbon. And it's one that I might tweak a little bit, but it's definitely one I'm going to make again and continue going with. It's easy drinking, but it's got some complexity, and it's very nice.
Is it pretty easy to scale up to, say, a five-gallon batch, you think?
Yeah. I mean, I don't see any reason why, you know, if you were in a five-gallon batch, you wouldn't just add 20 ounces of tart cherry juice and five bourbon staves or equivalent mm-hmm. amount, or, you know, bourbon-soaked oak chips or what you might want to do. Mm-hmm. If you wanted more bourbon flavor, you could probably put a few, you know, an ounce maybe of bourbon right in there with it. But this was great. It was getting some of the vanilla was coming off of that oak, and it was, like I said, very delicious.
Mm, that sounds good. That sounds like something that I might even want to give a try as well. What do you think it would be like carbonated?
That's what I'm thinking of. It was very yeah. good still, and I bottled it still. But if I do another batch of it, I'm going to carbonate at least 1 gallon, if not more of it. And I think I'm drinking this cherry, this cherry mead tonight, and it just got a little bit of effervescence, and that's really great. And I think I'm going to do that. My only thought is you might want to strengthen up the flavor just a little bit, because I think that you lose a little aroma and you lose a little taste when you've got that carbonation. So yeah. you know, maybe either leave it on longer or up the amount of bourbon and cherry juice in there.
What kind of honey did you use for that?
That's wildflower. That was a. I'm going to forget exactly why. I don't have my book in front of me, but so I couldn't tell you where the wildflower came from, but just a raw wildflower from, we'll call it somewhere between the Mississippi and the Rockies.
And you've got this one, let's see, grapefruit zest, cinnamon, allspice, nutmeg, orange peel, coriander, hops, and you've called it a Frankenstein mead.
So it started out as I started out making a dry Joe's. I was going to try to make a Joe's Ancient Orange, but I wanted to do it a little drier.
I was going to say that sounds like a Joe's Ancient Blue Moon.
Yeah, yeah. And so the first part of it came in from what I had on hand, and I started out with the grapefruit zest, the cinnamon, the allspice, the nutmeg, and it just wasn't coming around at all. You know, and then I thought, well, what the hell? Why don't I throw some orange peel, coriander, and hops on top of it, you know, the Blue Moon seasonings. And I thought I'd let it sit for a while. I bottled it. This one's more than a year old. I brought it to a party, opened it up. It hits you like a spice rack, like you're walking into a Turkish market. The aroma just hits you. And it's nothing you think you'd drink. I mean, it's something you think you'd, you know, rub on a piece of lamb. and the aroma is extremely strong. It tastes a little softer than it smells. I didn't particularly care for it, but there was a woman at the party who tasted it and she loved it. She just couldn't get enough. But I left her the bottle. I said, here, you know, you feel free to keep it. So I figure it's not all bad. If you got at least one person who likes it, it's not bad.
And how much had they had to drink already?
Not much. I know where you're going, but not much.
yeah, because at a certain point, I mean, it doesn't really matter what you're drinking, you know?
Yeah.
Like the girls all get prettier at closing time.
Yeah.
So this is a 1 gallon batch, so I bottled about 5 wine bottles out of it. And opened one. I'm gonna let the other 4. I'm gonna let them. I got a wine rack that can hold about 130 bottles. So I'm gonna let that one sit on, you know, sit in one of the areas for a while and see it come back in 2 or 3 years and open the next one and see how it's come along.
Is your wine rack floor to ceiling?
It is not. It is about four feet high. It's a square. It's about 4x4, and it's the diamond pattern. So yeah.
Oh, did we lose them?
You hear me, guys?
Oh yeah, there you are. Okay.
Yeah,
diamond pattern.
Yeah, so you lay the bottles on top of each other. You know, there's not individual slots for each bottle.
Okay. Yeah. I was just curious because I know, like the floor to ceiling type of wine racks, you should put certain wines at certain places because of the temperature. And yeah, it does get that serious sometimes when you're when you're doing this stuff. But interesting stuff, Ryan. You got a lot more going on here that we'll come back to. We want to hear about the beer that oxidized on you, and of course that one honey malt deal. We want to come back to that as well. But Jeff, let's throw it over to Jeff. Jeff, I get this email, and let's see, where's my notes? Well, I finally got my hands on a kegging setup. I think we talked about that before we went on break. Yep. So we kind of knew that was coming.
That was on the Christmas list.
Yeah. And then, and now you picked up a turkey fryer burner, and a 15.5 gallon. Am I reading this right? Kegel?
Yep. It's a, okay. Like a full size keg that they've cut the top off to make a boiling kettle.
A full size keg they cut the top off.
Yeah,
wow,
I'll send you
okay.
some. They cut it open and basically you're left with a big, I can't tell if it's aluminum or some kind of like pot steel, but I'm guessing it's aluminum. It's a 15-gallon kettle you can boil out of. It's got a little spot for a spigot, kind of like my stainless steel brew kettle. And, yeah, it can definitely handle brew in a bag or all-grain brews, things like that. So I'm finally taking that step up to the big game when it comes to beers and braggots and stuff like that.
There you go. I've considered – I would definitely love to get into an all grain setup, but I don't have room here. I've been toying around with the idea. This is another one that I got to squeeze by the wife somehow. You've heard me talk of the Grainfather. I've been looking at that and I keep looking at it and keep looking at it. There's several manufacturers out there that make, similar models, but it's an all in one deal. For all grain brewing. But like I said, I mean, it's just something that's just something that I really got to sit and think about and try to get past the wife. Cause I really don't think she'll put up with that, but that's the only way that I could ever get into an all grain, deal. But I'm just as happy doing the extract stuff now. So, right. But sounds like you're off to a pretty good start.
Yeah, I'm excited to get things rolling here. Hey, on the topic of wine racks, though, I have a couple of Facebook shout-outs I promised people. So do you mind if I get those out of the way?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay. So regarding wine racks, I had a comment from Peter Cornelli, I think is how you say his name, in Mead. He asked about wine racks and what people are using for storage and stuff. And actually, the shout-out, I was going to somebody that responded. A guy named Jeff Kane answered with these really impressive pictures of a wine rack he built himself. It's a lot of the diamond pattern with some spaces like kind of upright for bottles to sit upright in, but they're narrow and they're separating the diamond patterns. Oh. Not only is it a really impressive like two-wall display that he posted there, but he also posted some pretty general, not like plant by plant or cut list directions, but some directions for how he made them themselves so that other people can kind of replicate what he did and build on that themselves too. I thought that was a really awesome answer to the question. I wanted to throw him a shout out. And then I also saw a first time question from William Battenfield in the Mead Makers group. We talk a lot about, you know, measuring gravity and measuring pH and, you know, keeping right. good notes as far as quantitative numbers when we're making mead. He wanted to know, when is it a good time to sample and how do you know when you get there? And this kind of brought a question to my mind. I mean, when do you guys actually try your mead while you're making it? And what are you looking for? Because obviously it's not going to taste like the finished product when it's brewing. So just a food for thought kind of a question. What do you what are you guys looking for when you sample your mead and when do you sample it?
I don't know, Chris.
Well, when I make mine, of course, you know, I brew in a bucket, so I don't have to take mead out into a test jar to test gravity. I drop my hydrometer right in the bucket, and I've got this habit of dripping the hydrometer in my mouth, so that's about all the tasting that I do. It's kind of like a kid licking the mixer, the beaters after your mom makes a cake.
I was waiting for him to say, I'm just an old country boy. I got a dipper hanging on the side of the bucket, and I just pick it up and dip me some.
Well, I could, you know, but no, I don't really taste. I guess the first real tasting is when I rack out of primary. And then it's really only just a little bit that what's left in the hose of the racking cane, just to see, you know, is this worth keeping more or less? Mm-hmm. And I don't expect much at that point. If you can do everything perfect and it's still not going to really be impressive coming out of primary usually. But it's amazing that a well-made mead can change just in a couple of weeks. I mean, coming out of primary, getting off the yeast, and it settles down and the yeast drop out. And, you know, just in a matter of 2 weeks, it's totally changed. So I don't really, you know, I only taste coming out of primary just to make sure that it's not, you know, something horribly wrong. Other than that, I don't even worry about it until it's at least cleared up. So,
Ryan, with all these projects you got going on here, you know, that we kind of dug into, do you taste as you go?
Yeah, I'm about 50-50 on tasting the must. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. And then like Chris, I typically taste, going from primary to secondary. And then, depending on what it is, my stuff just stays there for a while. I have some stuff that sits in secondary for months and months and months at a time, and other stuff that's meant to come out a lot quicker. So after that, it just kind of get in my mind when I'm going to taste it. You know, this is 2 weeks. This is 2 months. This is 6 months. And I kind of go from there. I, you know, just kind of laissez-faire a little bit in what I do after, you know, or I should say once it's in secondary.
Yeah.
You sort of get this after you do it for a while. You sort of get to know the meads that you make, especially if it's something you make over and over. And it almost gets to the point where you can taste it and you can go, yeah, that's not going to be ready to drink for, 2 months. Or you taste it and you go, yeah, I could, another couple of weeks, that'll be ready. And you can almost predict it.
After
you've done it a while,
That's what I'm finding out. I used to taste all the time. And at first I was curious. I wanted to taste it and see, what about this stuff was changing over time, So, like every other day, maybe once a week, once every 4 or 5 days, I'd get a little, turkey baster and I'd suck some out, maybe a shot glass worth and take a taste. But anymore, I taste it when I mix it, when I put it together and put it in the fermenter, and I don't touch it again until I rack it. And I figure, it's going to do whatever is going to happen to the taste. I'm going to have probably little control over, unless it's something like pH or the yeast going south on me. But other than that, it is what it is until you're done. So I don't taste it again until I rack it, just to see, where it's at. And like Chris says, you can almost predict, like these two braggots that I got going. One, I was actually going to let it sit, for several months, but the more I kept tasting it, and I thought, man, this stuff is ready to go now. So we'll talk about that here in a little while, too. But, Aaron, what do you do? How do you taste your meads?
Well, I'll tell you, now that I've started following the TASNA protocol, and one of the habits that I found I've gotten myself into is when I go to make my Fermade O edition, I pull out maybe a half a cup or so of the must, and then I'll add in the Fermade O and kind of stir it in so that, I don't know how you'd really describe that, like a dust or the powdered Fermade O mixes in thoroughly. And when I'm pulling out a small sample to do that with, I find that now I'm always pulling out just a little bit extra to take a little bit of a taste. So usually during that first week of primary fermentation, I'm taking, maybe 3 or 4 tastes. Then I pretty much let it sit until it's time to rack to secondary. But definitely at that point, I'm taking another sample and tasting it. I think, Chris, same with you. Usually at that point, I don't have super high expectations for it. Although it has been remarkable to me just with the TASNA method, how much smoother of a mead I'm getting after the primary. And after that, I am a little bit worried, maybe overly worried about oxidation. So once it's in secondary, I have a tendency to just leave it there and not touch it again until it's cleared, at which point I'll have another taste at bottling. But maybe that's something I don't have to worry about quite as much as I typically do. It seems like a lot of people that you talk to or a lot of things that you read, people are not quite as hesitant as I am to bust into it a little bit and take a little sample from secondary. So, but typically that's how I usually do it.
Yeah. Interesting. Anything else there, Jeff?
And I got an email. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no, for the most part, my sampling regimen is pretty close to you guys. I don't bother, tasting it very much. Until racking from primary to secondary, I'll get another taste when I think it's time to move off to secondary and into bottling or bulk aging. And my only treatment regimen differs if I've got something that's sitting on in secondary, like oak, for example, or I've been playing around with vanilla beans lately in a couple of my different meads, and you want to keep tabs on those so they soak up just the flavor you're wanting and not going overboard on it. Otherwise, I don't taste very much at the start. Really, when I do taste, I'm just looking to make sure kind of like you guys are talking about, there's almost an instinctual understanding of what it's supposed to taste like. And I, more than anything, I'm just trying to make sure that it's going the right direction. There's no discernible flaws or anything creeping up from primary.
Making sure you don't, you know, you're not tasting the nutrients that you put in or something like that, you know. But if you taste coming out of primary expecting something impressive, you're going to be disappointed every time. No matter how good your mead is going to be, it's hardly ever impressive coming out of primary. So, you know, if you taste it, then don't taste with expectations of tasting something good. Do like we were talking about, just taste it for the purpose of making sure that something hasn't gone horribly wrong. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the only time that I really would change up my tasting is if I add something. You know, if you're going to add even wood, vanilla, you know, if you're going to put something in secondary to affect the flavor, then I'm going to monitor that pretty closely because, you know, you don't want to overdo it. But other than that, I mean, it is what it is. And I mean, if it's good, if it tastes good when I rack it, you know, I got to, and I know it's going to be good, you know, in the end. So, and I've really calmed down because I used to taste it all the time. You know, that was a major concern of mine in the early days. But,
JD, I got an email that I need to address real quick.
Sure.
It was from a fellow named Kerry Dotson, and he said he enjoyed the show. He had been listening, and he was asking a few questions to see if I could help him out. He says that he had heard us mention several times on the show that I like to get to the bottle real quick, that I don't let things hang around, and I don't. I like to make something and get on to drinking it, you know. So
yeah.
His question was, aside from my temperature control, what are some of the things that I do and in what order do I do them in order to be able to bottle so quickly and drink? Okay, well, I'm going to try to answer this because it's going to be a general answer. It varies from mead to mead, and you'll learn after a while, sort of instinctively, just like the aging thing, what you need to do. But basically what I have started doing in the last year and a half or so is I've learned that degassing and clearing the mead as quickly as possible helps the aging process tremendously. So obviously I've spent quite a bit of experimentation on clearing agents and different methods of degassing. And aside from proper temperature control while you're fermenting, post-fermentation, I think maybe the single most important thing you can do to get your mead drinkable quickly is degassing and clearing. So that would be the short answer. Now, he asked, in what order do I do things? And he said, please be specific. So I'll try. I'm usually a 3 to 4 week primary, almost always. And after 4 weeks in primary, I go into secondary, and it goes directly into the fridge to cold crash, because I want to get anything that will settle out, I want to settle it out as quickly as possible. So usually maybe 4 days, 5 days or so in the fridge to get it to settle. I take it out. I put in my Camden tablets at that point, put the airlock back on, and let it sit for another week or so. And by that point, it's about as clear as it's going to get naturally, unless you let it sit for a year. So if you want it clearer than that, you're going to have to take some action to do that. There's no reason to add any clarifying or fining agents until you degas it, because they just don't work that well. You've got to get that CO2 out to decrease the buoyancy of the liquid. Otherwise, it's going to keep yeast and everything else suspended in it. So I've got my first round of sulfites. I've been sitting a couple of weeks, and we're fairly on our way to clearing. So I'll usually, at that point, I'll pull out enough mead out of the carboy to make sure I've got room for my clarifying agent. And then I go one of two directions, depending on the mead and my taste. Mostly tannin is the thing that I'm worried about the most. So if I want to preserve the tannin that I have, I'll use a Super Clear, which is a two-part fining agent. If I feel like it's got too much tannin and I need to get rid of some of it, I'll use gelatin first, followed by bentonite. And but in either case, I give it, you know, another week or so to settle. I degas it, by the way, with a food saver, and I hook up a hose, the same kind I use on my racking cane, to my food saver, and then you can rig up a drilled stopper. In my case, it happens that it fits right down in the drill stopper, so I don't have to do anything. And pull a vacuum on it, and you'll see all the gas coming out, and just get all you can out. Add your fining agent and let it sit for a couple of weeks. And generally at that point, you can bottle, because you're as clear as you're going to get, and this thing at that point, you know, is a couple of months old from the day you pitched it. So if you did everything right, there's no reason why you can't bottle at that point. Drinkable? Yes. Good? Yes. Will it get better? Yes. Is it worth waiting an entire year? It depends. Some are and some aren't. So, you know, I can't give you firm answers on that kind of thing, because I've got meads that I make on a regular basis. And in 2 months from the day I pitch the yeast, they're good enough for anybody to drink. I've got some others that do benefit from, you know, 8, 9, 12 months of aging. But most of what I make, it's just, you just don't gain enough. I mean, it's diminishing returns past a couple of months. So, yeah. You know, why wait? Just drink it.
So, Chris, I wanted to, you were talking about when you were doing your clearing process protocols. You know, wine kits, I don't know if you've ever done a wine kit, but wine kits have you add the bentonite up front. And I mean, right into the must, you add your bentonite, you know, before you even pitch your yeast. And it helps.
You cut out.
You're here. Say it again, Ryan. Yeah. You just cut out there just a couple seconds.
So, when you do a wine kit, they add bentonite. They have you add the bentonite up front before you even pitch your yeast. You know, you add it right when you're making your must, and it supposedly helps you with clearing, you know, all the way through in the beginning there. Now I've never done that with a mead, but I figure, you know, I have some bentonite, and I'm gonna, next time I've got one, make something that I know doesn't typically clear very well, I'm going to try that. I'm going to try to add the bentonite, you know, right up front, you know, before I even pitch my yeast, and see if, you know, how that clears, how that helps it, you know, especially when you're right, when you're going from your primary to secondary.
Well, I can tell you it works much better if you start out with the gelatin first. Using the bentonite after fermentation, I'm not really sure how much the bentonite does for the meat itself if you used it alone. I use the bentonite more or less to get the gelatin to settle on out. So what I do, you know, I'll start out with my gelatin, like a, I think it's an eighth of a teaspoon for each gallon of mead. And you dissolve that, use about a half a cup of water for every eighth of a teaspoon. And, you know, it has to be in pretty hot. And so you stir it up really good. Pour it in immediately before it cools because it will start to gel. And so you put your gelatin in, and I use Knox gelatin from the grocery store. It's like 225 bloom, I think. It's the same exact thing you buy at the homebrew store. So you pour that in and wait about, I don't know, an hour, maybe 2 hours, and then follow it up with your bentonite solution. And the bentonite somehow just takes the gelatin right on down to the bottom.
If you're going to use bentonite, be very careful because I've played around with that stuff. I do wine kits here at the house too, and they, you know, like you say, they always have you add this bentonite. Typically, it's up front, but it's about a, I'm going to guess that probably maybe 3 teaspoonfuls in this package, maybe a little less, maybe 2 teaspoons. And you have to boil like a quart of water. It's got to be really hot because, and keep the water has to be moving when you put your bentonite in, because if it doesn't, it's going to clump up and it's like little nobules of mucky little clay. And you'll never
I
get
use
it.
A blender.
Yeah, even a blender works too.
But yeah, I use 1 tablespoon of bentonite in 1 cup of hot water, boiling water. Pour a cup of boiling water in the blender, put a tablespoon of bentonite in while it's running, and you know, let it run for a couple of minutes and then let it sit for a, you know, 15 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And then once you've got that mixture made up, then you use about, oh, I don't know, I think it's about 2 tablespoons of that solution per gallon. And that's all you need. Yeah. And another benefit of doing that is that the addition of that layer of gelatin causes a good firm yeast cake. So in the event that you're using something like 71D that tends to make fluffy kind of loose lees, the gelatin helps to prevent getting that in your racking.
Yeah. Well, I hope we
but
covered
I still
it.
Prefer, yeah, I still prefer the super clear. If I'm not worried about tannins or anything, I only use the gelatin and bentonite if I'm trying to take out some tannins, because you know, honestly, gelatin will definitely bring out. It'll definitely strip some tannins out.
Honestly, Chris, the one time that I've tried using fining agents to remove some tannins, I also used gelatin, but I actually just followed it up with super clear after that. I forget which way the ionic balance goes on those, but you know, the logic of it is you want to follow one with the other so that you get both sides of it.
Right.
The first ingredient in the super clear, the kieselsol, salt, is actually the opposite ionic balance to the gelatin, so they counteract each other really well. That makes the second ingredient, the super clear, kind of superfluous, but I went ahead and did it anyway because, you know, good results are good results. And that worked out pretty well for me. I got the really good clearing qualities of the super clear, and it stripped out some of that tannin that I needed out of the mead too. So you might try that sometime too and see what kind of results you get that way.
Yeah, I will. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe the reason I started doing it this way was for that very reason. It was because bentonite did have the opposite charge. So
I think you're right. Pretty sure it does.
I may have read that somewhere. So this is one of those things that I've been doing for a while, and I don't remember why I started, but it works. So I never changed it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It just kind of becomes your standard operating procedure. So that's the best answer I can give you. Degas it, get that CO2 out. You're going to reduce some of your tartness. I don't think people really understand just how much tartness that a little bit of carbonation and dissolved CO2 and carbonic acid can add. So just getting the CO2 out alone will push your aging forward tremendously. And then getting all that junk to settle out and get it to clear, you can take a mead that's just so-so and degas it and fine it, and you'd be surprised how much better it tastes. So that's my suggestion to you. So go experiment, and if you find a better way, let me know.
There you go. Do you guys ever wind up with leftovers, like leftover grains and leftover ingredients, and you wonder what the hell to do with them? No?
I've got four bottles of honey here from that honey varietal experiment that I'm looking at right now. So
yeah, or, you know, a little bit of leftover honey, not enough for a complete batch, or you know, you got a half a pound of grain that you used a half a pound with another recipe already. You know, you got a half an ounce of hops because the other recipe called for just. Well, that's kind of what I wound up with. I had these grains left over from, I believe it was the Graph project that I put together, and it was the Crystal 120L. I had from a beer project, actually it was from a Braggot project, I had pulled out 2 pounds of dry malt extract of the wheat, the Breeze wheat to dry malt extract. So I had 2 pounds of that, and had like a half an ounce of hops. We were talking about this before, and I had sent out the email, and I said, here's what I got. You know, send me a recipe. What would you do with this stuff? So several of you emailed me back. And Aaron, you won. It's been on the bucket now for probably 6 days. This is the 71B project that I'm calling. It's you named it chocolate coffee oatmeal Dunkelweizen style Braggot.
Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah. So basically what it consists of is the half pound of caramel 120L that I had left, plus an additional quarter pound of steel cut oats that I already had. That's the Coach's Oats, and if you haven't had Coach's Oats, they are the absolute best. You get them at Costco, so I thought I'd throw that out there. But so we steeped all that at 150 degrees, and Aaron was quite meticulous about this, 100 strike temperature between 120 and 135, hold the temperature at 133, 30 minutes, so on and so forth. We brought it all to a boil, did the hop additions and everything. Put the 2 pounds of Bavarian wheat DME in. Went through this whole boiling thing. Added, it was a little over 3 pounds of wildflower honey, Aaron, okay, in order to come up to, the gravity that we were looking for. About one, I think I wound up at 1.100, so it was just 10 shy. And I thought, well, that's okay. I can live with that.
Close enough, yep.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about the coffee, and I thought, usually I like to do the coffee in secondary, but I thought, you know what? I'm going to stay right with this thing that Aaron sent. So we steeped coffee beans. I crushed them this time. I crushed the beans with my tenderizing mallet, and we pitched 71B. So it's in the bucket. It's about 2.5 gallons. And it's in the bucket. Now I only fed it once, 24 hours after it started. I tossed in some Fermade K. That's it. So I thought, you know what? I remember the discussion that we had here a while back with one of our guests, treat it like a beer. Okay. So that's exactly what I did. I haven't touched it. I stirred it up gently a couple of times, during the fermentation. It's pretty much done with fermenting, as much as I can tell for now. But I'm just going to give it probably another week and a half or so in the bucket, and then bust it open and drain it off into a couple of 1 gallon carboys and see what we got.
Awesome.
So I mean, it tasted good. I took a little sample of it when we put it in the fermentation bucket, my little 5 gallon bucket, and it tastes pretty decent, so I got high hopes, dude.
that's awesome. I'm just laughing. I remember when you sent the email around to the group and you had just these kind of random assortment of leftover ingredients that you had. And the first thought that I had is like, this sounds like a show on the Food Network, like one of those things where you got like a cooking competition and everyone's given some random set of ingredients and asked to make something out of it. And I just thought, what a cool idea for a show. I would watch that.
Yeah, like that one Chopped, I think it is, where they open up the basket and here's all these random things you got to make a meal out of or something. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, but guys, Chris, you usually wind up with leftover stuff. If you do, what do you do with it?
Well, I've only recently started getting into the grains, and everything that I've had left over so far, my wife has made bread from it. So
there you go.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to make any other beverages. Anything that's left over, even after I steep the grains, she makes multigrain bread from it, and it's been pretty doggone good.
Yeah. Do you now the grains come crushed already? Does she grind them up even further? Because they're still pretty coarse.
No, it's more like a whole grain, multi-grain bread. She still uses like wheat flour so she puts that in as sort of added fiber, I guess. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, I make bread here at home too, and I didn't even give it a thought. So, when I pull the grain bag out next time, by God, I'm going to hang on to it, let it dry out, and make some bread with it. But Aaron,
the best one so far has been when I made the stout, and it had some English chocolate malt in it, and that so far that's been the best.
What the bread?
Yeah,
bread, chocolate bread.
I made cookies with chocolate malt.
I remember you. Really? Yeah, I remember you saying something that you made cookies. Well, you also made cookies with your cocoa nibs too, right?
For cake. Yeah, I make a lot of cookies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I make a lot of cookies.
Well, Aaron, Ryan, I mean, you guys, I mean, the leftover stuff that you wind up with, I mean, do you, you know, what's the plan? Do you have a plan for them, or?
Yeah, you know, I always end up with, you know, extra stuff or things that are unused. And to me, it goes into a couple of different categories. I kind of sort the stuff by its shelf life. And so, you know, liquid malt extract, you know, is supposedly good for about a year from the date that it was bottled. As far as I know, dry malt extract is good forever. Maybe some, you know, or at least a while. You know, the grains, you know, unless they're probably in sealed bags, are, you know, you want to use those. Hops, you know, you can freeze, but those definitely have a shelf life. So I make enough stuff where, you know, I don't have to necessarily make a leftover kit or a leftover batch. Yeah. I should say left, you know, but what I do is if I don't plan on using something and it's the shelf life is going to lose its, you know, it's going to lose its integrity. I try to find a way to repurpose it and to extend that. So I talked in the last show, I've made extracts. You know, you can make a hop extract, you know, just the way you'd make a vanilla extract. Sure. You know, you can make a cocoa nib extract if you want to do that. I've done some of that kind of thing. And you know what I do though? I've probably got 4, 5, 6 pounds of dry malt extract. And that I am going to make into a recipe here. I got a pound of, not a pound, maybe a half pound or a quarter pound of some specialty grain, 5 or 6 pounds of dry malt extract, 2 ounces of hops, you know, and that stuff has just come together. And I mean, that is basically a batch of beer right there. You know, add a pound of honey, make it a braggot. Sure. But, you know, but I guess I try to sort it out in my mind and on my shelf here to say, okay, what's the shelf life of this stuff? And then over time, you know, as you're using it, like it just comes together in that way where now it makes sense for this batch, of beer braggot, just as the things have accumulated, you know, within their shelf lives.
Yeah. Jeff, you, run into that same, deal, leftover stuff?
Well, you know, here or there, when I do brew grain stuff, I'm obviously not until now, brewing with very much at all, you know, a pound or two here is steeped, added to a lot of extract. Yeah. I've had a pound and a half, 2 pounds of dry malt extract in the cabinet that actually sat there for nearly a year and became more or less concrete because it's so hydrophilic. I just didn't have the package sealed properly or something like that, I guess. And I probably could have dissolved it in hot water, but I just didn't feel like messing with it. So I ended up pitching that. I know I do have, oh my God, I have a small treasure trove of hops at the moment that I need to figure out some various applications for because, they're bound to get added.
You've got hops for sale, Chris?
Not for you. Not, they need to be. You know, that's aggravating when you buy, you know, an ounce at a time and then you get a recipe that's got, you know, 1 1/4 ounces and you're left with, 3/4 of an ounce or half an ounce or something. Next thing you know, you've got 7 or 8 packs of hops that are half full, and you don't know what to do with them.
Well, in my case, it's even worse. A lot of these just fell into my lap. I've still got, I want to say, 2 or 3 ounces of Mosaic hops that I got from joining American Homebrew Association over the summer. For the contest when I had this summer or fall, I also got another 4-ounce package of Apollo hops. It'll make a really good IPA. And then I actually got some really freshly picked hop varieties, a few different. I want to say I've got about 2.5 ounces each of Cascade, Centennial, and Sterling hops in my freezer that are all just like freshly dehydrated flowers that were picked back in September.
Okay. Well, so rather than letting them sit around, why put them to use, right?
Exactly. So lots of braggots and ales in my future, I think.
Well, and I mean, this is it was kind of fun because, when I sent that email around, I thought, let's see what these guys can come up with. And sure enough, several of you came through. And a couple of you even came through for some secondary editions after the fact that I'm considering as well, too. So, but when this comes out of primary, they'll go into a couple of gallon jugs, and one might get, vanilla bean or two, and another one might get some chocolate nibs, some roasted cocoa nibs. But and we'll see what comes of it. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we've really been on this braggot thing for a long time. I think we've been on this longer than we were the coffee, and I don't want people to start getting bored hearing us talk about braggot. They're probably going, right, "Where's the rest of the mead?" But yeah. I just got to say that. I'm the kind of person that when I try something and I fail, I'm going to pretty much keep on until I succeed or convince myself that I need to stop. I've been on this quest to find the perfect base beer for what I would consider to be a good braggot. Now, and you all know that by now that I have totally different taste in mead than some of you guys do. So I've been looking around to see, and naturally it started leading me toward more heavy beers that are made that way traditionally. And so I sort of focused in on two distinct styles, and I managed to get my hands on some. And for those of you who haven't heard of this or tried it, you need to get your hands on a Scottish Wee Heavy.
What was that again? Say that again. A Scottish what?
Wee Heavy. A Wee Heavy.
Scottish Wee Heavy.
Heavy.
Yep. Heavy.
Heavy. You know. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
I got my hands on a couple of examples of it, and I really believe this is where I think a braggot should go for me personally. And it is, as soon as I can get something freed up here, I've still got I got some bottling done today. I've still got some more to go. And as soon as I get enough things freed up, the next two things going in the bucket is a Scottish Wee Heavy Braggot, and the other one is going to be a Belgian Quad. And I came across that looking at Northern Brewer's website, and I was looking at their Northy 12 that they have. And so that's going to be the next one. So I think the Scottish Wee Heavy is going to be the one.
I picked up. Well, what can you describe the Wee Heavy? What is it?
It's malty, slightly sweet, heavy bodied, low hops, very little, if any, bitterness whatsoever. Caramelly, almost. Just everything that I imagine it should be, a braggot and a beer combination. The Belgian quad is a little bit more spicy. It almost has a fruity quality to it. Very malty, once again, low on bitterness. It has a little bit more bitterness than the Wee Heavy. It's got sort of a, well, the one that I picked up had what I would describe as a raisin type, almost a fruit cake without the spices type flavor. I think those two are going to be the winners for me, and I think the Scottish Wee Heavy is going to be the number one. So
I went shopping at Midwest Supply, and I remember, I think it was Ryan talking about, they've got a line of beer kits, Simply Beer, I think it's called, or Simple Beer or something like that.
Yeah, Beer Simply Beer.
Yeah, I ordered a cream ale that I want to work on a braggot, but this time I'm going to use a lighter honey. I'm going to use orange blossom, and I'm thinking I got oranges on the brain, so I'm thinking orange peels or some kind of orange extract or something in the boil or secondary. But I want to try to get an orange flavor out of it, and then I also ordered a and this is more for my wife, but an Irish stout that I thought I would dump some honey in and turn that into a braggot as well, but maybe add a little coffee. But I think we're probably we've spent some time on these braggots, and I think I know Chris and I, we've been pretty heavy into brewing these things here recently. I know the other guys have done their share. I bottled my first braggot, and as you recall, I bought two identical kits, the bourbon barrel. I added 2 pounds of honey. The other kit, I took out 2 pounds of dry malt extract and added 2 pounds of honey. And, boy, they taste wildly different. Now, granted, each one of them has a different bourbon. The one I bottled up here, I put it in a keg, got it carved up. I started sipping it, tasting it, and I managed to bottle a case. So I must have drank a case already. Go figure. But it's good. But it's a 13%. So when you drink this stuff, you want to be sitting down. The braggot thing, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, we talked about it here a couple of shows ago. I mean, this goes back to Aaron's braggot. This is the kind of mead that I like. This is my mead, this braggot stuff. So that's what I'm going to be doing mostly of. Ciders. Let's talk ciders here for a minute. I started one, Chris, as you well know. This is the Simply Apple. Kind of goes along with the graph thing. Used,
Boy, is that graph not the weirdest thing you ever made?
Yeah, let's spend a minute on that. Yeah, that's like... Yeah, that is the weirdest thing. The recipe is on the website, meathouse.com, for the graph. and it's made like a beer. I mean, you're basically building a wort. You're steeping grains. You're adding malt extract. I mean, you're going through this whole stage of boiling this wort, and then finally you dump it into, you know, apple juice. And I used, I don't remember, I can't remember what yeast I used. It was an ale yeast.
We used the Nottingham.
Nottingham.
But usually, I mean, with this particular recipe, if you go by the strictly, you end up with 1 gallon of wort and 4 gallons of apple juice or apple cider.
Yeah.
But you and I both have found at making this that the thing that stands out to us the most is that it doesn't taste the same twice, and it hasn't
weekly
since we made it.
Yeah, weekly. Almost weekly.
Yeah, I mean, really just even a few days. And it goes good, and then it goes bad, and then it turns good again, and you wait a week, and it's back tasting pretty bad. And I'm just waiting to see where this thing finally settles and what happens. But it hasn't tasted the same way twice since I made it. So
no,
I finally, about a, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, I finally just said, you know what, I'm finished tasting it. I'm putting it back, and I'm not even going to bother tasting it for at least another month. And give it time to settle down and maybe see where it's going to be.
Yeah.
weirdest thing I've ever made. I've never made anything that changed that much that quickly.
That's
and then went backwards. It goes forward, and then it goes backwards.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just almost on a weekly basis. There was something different about it every time I took a taste. And I have it. I mean, it's hooked up to my kegerator system in the freezer unit, and I put a little picnic tap on it because I didn't want to run it through my regular tower, and I just leave it hooked up, and it's carved up very nicely. But right today, I mean, when I tasted it yesterday, it had almost a metallic tartness to it that it didn't have the week before. So I'm hoping that's going to go away. I mean, it tastes good. Don't get me wrong. It's perfectly drinkable. You know, I mean, it's not like you're chewing on, you know, a piece of tin or anything like that. It's just got this weird tart.
Yeah, mine's a couple of weeks ahead of yours, and it went through the same thing, and then the metallic taste went away, and one week you taste it and it's just way too tart, and the next week you taste it and you go, dang, I wish this had some little more acidity to it. It's kind of flabby.
And it's got a it's got kind of an amber Pilsner amber. Kind of reminds me of a Pilsner type beer.
Yeah, a little
beer
bit.
Type. It's an amber color.
I think a lot of that beer quality will go away once some of the apple flavor starts to come back.
Well,
when I first tasted, like the first week after it was finished, I had lots and lots of apple. And now I have no apple at all. I mean, like zero.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and everything that I've ever read about cider is that it takes a very long time for the apple to come back, to get that apple flavor. So I've got this cider that I started. It's pure apple juice and just enough honey to bring it up to, I think it was 1.060 is where I started. And I used Dan Starr's Windsor, which is a British ale yeast. I'm, I'm trying to get something close to a Magners. If you guys haven't had Magners, it's an imported Irish cider that's out of this world. I mean, it's absolute the best that I've had. If you can find it in your area, but, I'm trying to emulate that. So but it's going to take a while. I know. But I'm hoping to have some pretty good results out of that too. But,
I want to hear about the beer that went bad.
Yeah. let's go back to Ryan because he contacted us in an email and said, well, let's let Ryan describe this thing. You got a beer going and something happened to it.
Yeah, I had a red rye IPA going that I was really excited about. You know, it had... It was an extract brew with some specialty grains, brilliant red color, a lot of hops, spiciness from the rye. I use an Oktoberfest yeast. That's good malt to it. It was a beer that I was really excited about. I got really busy. And it was sitting in the fermentation room, airlock was on it. And I came back, I was getting ready. I was 2 days away from what I thought was going to be putting it into the bottling bucket and adding the priming sugar and getting going with it. And it's no longer this beautiful, garnet color. It's now black, which, it somehow, some way it oxidized. It got oxidized, has, the faintness of that wet cardboard that goes along with it. Don't exactly know how it happened. I mean, I knew it was sitting a little longer than I thought it was going to. And I'm not one who likes to quit without a fight. And I was listening to another podcast and a guy had said that he had embarked on a 2-year sour project. And along the way, one of his beers had gotten oxidized and he soured it, and over a couple of years he goes it turned into something that was really delicious. Now, in the grand scheme of things, you look back and you go, Ryan, you had 30 bucks into this batch of beer, it oxidized, clean the drains with it and start over. Yeah, maybe, but I've also got the time and the space. So, I'm going to add some Brett strains to it and let it go and see if over some time this, the Brett, really kind of turns this thing around and turns it into something different, but good. And we'll see how that turns out. So that's the one that went bad.
Hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, over the next couple of years.
I want to get some Brett going in a mead and see what happens, but I'm scared because, I'm afraid that my equipment's going to get infected with it. And then it's going to be everywhere. I've heard horror stories from people about that. So I've been putting it off until I could dedicate some equipment to that I knew that I would never have to use again on anything else.
Yeah, could you like come up with some kind of a little isolation type deal?
Well,
where...
I was thinking about waiting until the weather sort of stabilizes and moderates a bit, and then just moving that entire operation out to my garage and just keep it totally separate,
totally
different equipment and in a different space and everything. And I have also heard that it's not that easy to sour a mead because they're so resistant to infections that, you know, we all worry about infections when we're brewing, especially lower ABV stuff. But if I remember correctly, you know, Frank Goldbeck at Gold Coast was talking about making some sour meads, and he said they really had a difficult time trying to get a mead to sour because it was so, you know, it would just kill off the bacteria. So I don't know.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because that brings me to my next little surprise that was awaiting me in the fermenting room when I got back down to it. And you guys remember I was telling you how I did this. I had the Canadian honey malt that I had cold steeped, and I kind of forgot about it, and it cold steeped for a week, I think I said, or something like that. And and I added a pound of honey to it, and then I added I forget what kind of yeast. It was either US05 or it was 1116, and I'm gonna forget exactly which one. Doesn't make much difference. It fermented all the way down, fermented dry, and then I came back and the thing had soured on me. It had totally soured on me. It had a wonderful, almost a barnyardy, you know, smell to it, and it had developed a really nice pellicle. You know, this kind of white, bubbly, foamy, you know, kind of like a mud looking thing almost, you know, pond scum, you know, on the top. And that it really, really interesting how that just kind of happened. I mean, I guess one of two things might have happened. There was either something was either in the malt that just came out because there was no boil, and I didn't boil it. I just added the honey right from the cold steep. Or I suppose there could have been something in the honey, and while the honey was in its dense, you know, pure state, nothing's going to happen to it. But once you diluted it out, you know, that was able to take hold and grow. But either way, I'm excited. I'm excited about it. I look forward to seeing what's going to happen to it. It soured really quickly. I mean, we're talking in just a matter of weeks or whatever that might have been, maybe a month or something. It soured and developed very quickly. So whatever this was pretty interesting. And I think if it tastes good, I'm gonna, you know, kind of keep something like that around and continue to use that one over and over again. And Chris, kind of what you say about the concerns of contamination, you know, I've heard of, I think beer brewers and especially, and also a lot of winemakers and some mead makers, but especially brewers get almost OCD about cleanliness and sanitation. And that's not a bad thing at all. That's a good thing. But at some point, it comes down to, do you trust your cleaning and sanitation or don't you? I mean, I've heard of guys that'll say, oh my God, there's a scratch in this carboy. I'm never going to use this carboy again because something funky could hide out in that little scratch. And I said, okay, well, let's walk through that logically. If something got into that scratch, that means that things can get into it. That means water can get into it. That means sanitizers can get into it. That means, you know, one-step cleaners, two-step cleaners can get into it. And it's either you trust your tools and you trust yourself, or you don't. And, you know, and with bacteria and you're talking about souring, of course you've got to make sure that your sanitizers and cleaners can kill it, you know, but if they can kill it, then is it logical to say that once you use this siphon that it can never be used again, if in fact you can clean it and sanitize it and be sure that everything that touched that bacteria has been cleaned and sanitized. Mm-hmm. You know, feel free to disagree with me there on hospital protocol, but I, as I talk through this and think through this with people, it really comes back to the, you know, and I'm not trying to pick on beer brewers, but their paranoia and obsessive compulsiveness with sanitization to a point where it almost sometimes becomes illogical in you know, in them not necessarily trusting that something can be cleaned or sanitized.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I'll be the first to admit that it, you know, this is an entirely different kind of bacteria that we're talking about from what I'm used to dealing with. But in the same vein here, no pun intended, you know, what I'm used to dealing with, I know firsthand can be very virulent, even with some really, really industrial strength cleaners and sanitizers and disinfectants. So naturally, my paranoia is going to carry over, having seen that firsthand. But then I have to remind myself, this is a whole different, you know, it's a whole different world to what I'm used to dealing with at work. So, you know, I don't get overly obsessive with it. I'm thorough with my sanitizing, but you know, it's like I've said before, people have said, why do you go to bother sanitizing your fermenter if you're just going to add spring water to it? Well, or you're going to rinse it with spring water. Well, it's the same water I'm mixing up my must. If it's clean enough to mix up your must with, it's clean enough to rinse your fermenter out with.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, I think a lot of people, they don't use their brains when, you know, they sort of go by what they instinctively believe or something they've read or heard.
Or what, yeah, okay, come my way.
No, I'm not coming your way.
This goes back to when I first started out, Ryan. I mean, I was very anal about this stuff because it had everything to do with what I read. Okay. And the biggest fear I had was a bacteria getting into my stuff and making somebody sick. And so I put my batches together in my kitchen, and let me tell you, all right, you can perform heart surgery. At one point, you could do heart surgery on the floor of my kitchen, all right, because I sanitized everything, the stove, the countertops, the drawers, I mean, everything. My entire kitchen was covered. I would just sanitize everything because I was very anal. I did not want some kind of, you know, and I'm thinking TV here. I'm thinking, you know, some god-awful monster movie you've seen on TV where something comes crawling out of the drain. I didn't want that infecting my stuff, my mead. So, yeah, there are people like that out there, and it has everything to do with what you read, and this goes back to these incomplete recipes that we find so common out there. They give you the basic ingredients, and that's it. They don't tell you the rest of the story, so you don't know what to expect out of it. And I think the sanitizing and cleanliness is the same way. I mean, there are people out there who just, you know, who make it a big, big point to talk about bacteria and infection and that kind of thing. That gives the rest of us newbies one of those oh shit moments, like, you know, okay, now I gotta mop the floor with sanitizer. Okay, so
yeah. Not changing the subject, but there's two pinups on our website now with brand new Mead House aprons, and I was just wondering why is Aaron not on there with them?
Well, Aaron got something different.
Oh, did he? I did, yeah. Yeah, can't wear what I got.
Aaron got something a little bit different. Just like Chris got something a little bit different. So I did mix, you know, yeah. Santa Claus had to mix it up a little bit. Santa Claus didn't shop at the same store.
Well, those are we need to make a calendar, and that's got to be January and February, right there. For sure.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Well, as we get, we need to wrap this up. What I want to do is throw it around the table just for a minute or two to each one of us. 2017 is upon us. You guys got anything planned? Anything new that you want to try? Let's start off with Aaron.
You know, I do. An announcement here too. My kitchen right now is an absolute disaster zone. We just got done redoing our bathrooms, and now we're redoing the kitchen. So I may not be doing anything for a little while here, but when I am able to again, you know, I think some of these braggots that we've been talking about are something I definitely want to play around with a little bit, but you know, I don't want this to come out the wrong way to some of these Groenfell meads, which I've still been sampling through and have just been thoroughly enjoying them. But as I've been drinking them, I just can't help but think to myself, what really got me into mead and what I personally really enjoy, I think is more in line with what Chris typically likes. And that would be more of like the Ken Schramm, Kurt Stock style, like wine style meads. Yeah. And, I can't stop thinking about what was that one from Sergio that he sent to us, Midnight Jack, that one that had all the what was it?
The dark,
dark tart berries.
Yeah.
Something with like black currants, raspberries, sour cherries, those types of things with a nice sweet honey backbone to kind of balance everything out. To me, that is one of the things on the top of my list that I want to get back into when I'm able to start brewing up some mead again.
When you get your package from me, you're gonna love it. Because you just described my flagship mead.
Would this be the famous Heart Murmur by chance?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
That also sounds like a recipe for the show coming up, Aaron. So we're going to task you with that maybe in the next month or so. Let's work on a recipe and put something that we can – something a little bit different than Chris's Heart Murmur, maybe something closer to Sergio's Midnight Jack. So we'll task you with that.
Sure. Yeah. Sounds good to me.
Ryan, you got anything on the back burner that you want to put out front for 2017?
Oh yeah, I've got two piments that I've got coming here, a white piment and a red piment. You know, I can get into those a little bit later. Another show, I mean, a couple of beers and a cider. So I mean, I've probably got four or five batches in my head here that, well, in my book and my head that I've wanted to get out for a while here. And now I've got a little more time now that the craziness of the holidays is almost behind us and the space here after bottling a few, to get them going. But I don't think it's going to take long for me to fill those carboys.
Perfect. You're up after Aaron, then. We're going to task you with a put us together a one-gallon recipe that we could throw up on the website, and those listening can make right along with us like we did the Orange Blossom special when we started out. Jeff, dude, you got some new equipment. I know you've been working on your fermentation refrigerator, and you got the keg set up and all this. You got to have something planned for 2017.
Oh gosh, I'm behind, because I tell you, I've still got a freezer full of I want to say 6 or 8 different varieties of fruit that I never made this summer because I didn't have that fermentation chamber done. I've got 2 or 3 different ragged styles that I want to explore some. You know, I've got a couple different ideas of experiments to do. I had a follow-up to my last experiment involving yeast instead of the nutrients. Then the show with Ricky had me going on an entirely different experimental idea with fermenting at high temperatures and things like that. I mean, like right now, I feel like I could do a mead a week if I had the energy to do it. And I'd still have ideas by the end of the year.
I'm gonna task you with a recipe, the clean out your freezer recipe. So let's see what you got in your freezer. Let's get a list, and we'll put the list up on the website. And I'm gonna task you with coming up with a recipe, make it something unique, something that not your typical this is not your typical clean out the freezer mead. Let's see if we can come up with something different.
Sure. Let's workshop it like your cleanup, and I'll give everybody the list. You guys come up with some ideas for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be fun.
Absolutely. Aaron, I guess we've been around the horn already. Did I miss anybody? But me, right? I've got my project already coming. The cream ale, working on this Braggot thing, that's where I want to be. So I'm going to be experimenting with some different beer recipes. Like Chris, I'm sampling some different beers. I want to try to find that base that I'm looking for, like Chris is talking about. I came up with this cream ale thing. I get this orange thing on my mind. So I'm that when it comes, and that's the direction I think I want to go. I want to leave everybody with a simple, you know, we're talking some low alcohol stuff here, and sometimes it's difficult to make sure that you get the, do away with that oxygen. I talked about oxygenation problem that he had. One way to solve that, and a simple trip to the hardware store. If you've got a keg set up with a CO2 bottle, put together a Y for your regulator. Okay, you got your regular feed for your kegs coming off of one side. The other side, you want to get the appropriate brass fittings and put together an air hose with an air nozzle. And that's what I use to fill that little 3, 4, 5 inch space at the top of the carboy after I rack. I just stick the air nozzle in there and blow CO2 into it, just kind of squirt it in there a little bit. Low pressure, You want to keep it on low pressure. You don't want to blast the stuff out of the carboy. But it's a simple method. I went from using the stuff you buy in the wine store for $10 a can to simply going to the hardware store, buying some air hose and the right fittings and an air nozzle and doing it that way. So, 10 feet of air hose, I can drag it over to my carboys every time I pull the bung out of it and take a sip or take a taste or check the gravity. I put a couple of squirts of CO2 in and throw the bung back on. So,
I've heard of people doing that before they rack into it. They'll prime it with some CO2. That way, when they put the hose in there, there's no chance of oxygen mixing before it fills up too. You're priming into the CO2 and you're just finding one less vector for oxygen.
Yeah, I do that with the kegs. When I clean and rinse out the kegs and sanitize my keg, I'll drop the airline down inside just hang on to it and put my hand down in there and just blow CO2 down inside of it just before I rack. So CO2.
And I'd be interested to hear just how many of you guys and how many of our listeners. Comparing a traditional mead to a Melomel, how many traditional meads have you oxidized and how many Melomels have you oxidized? Because I've oxidized way too many Melomels. I have yet to oxidize a traditional mead. So I'd like to hear from everybody how many you've managed to oxidize. I'm under the impression at this point that a traditional mead is very difficult to oxidize.
Yeah, good deal. All right. Well, hey, we'll be back next week. We're on a 6-2 schedule, so we'll run the show for the next 5 weeks. I believe February 7th is our last show. We'll take a couple of weeks off and then come back and do 6 more. So we'd like to take a little break in between. You can catch the show live, themeadhouse.com or tunein.com. You can download the app from TuneIn Radio. You can also catch the replays on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podcastpedia, and, of course, right here at our house, themeadhouse.com. With that, we'll see everybody next week. We'll come back and do it again.